Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is a show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is very special chef. It's Daniel Patterson, chef, food writer, and restaurateur behind some of California's best restaurants. Daniel started Daniel Patterson Group in 2006 with Qua, a small, quirky, fine dining restaurant that helped to change how people look at Northern California cuisine. Over the last 10 years, he and his team have opened 6 additional restaurants and bars in the Bay Area, and they started The Cooking Project, a nonprofit organization dedicated to teaching kids and young adults fundamental cooking skills. Daniel also teamed up with Chef Roy Choi to launch Local, a revolutionary fast food company designed to bring good jobs and real food to communities. Today, we'll talk about restaurant quality and the future of the industry. Chef, welcome to A Hungry Society.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So I don't know if a lot of people know, but you're doing this really cool project with Restaurant Opportunity Center, and you wrote this great piece for Food and Wine recently. Can you talk a little bit about that essay that you wrote?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just to kind of give some background, maybe a year and a half ago, a little bit more, Rock, which does a lot of work with labor, workers' rights across the country, and they've grown into a pretty powerful advocate for equitable work environments. They're opening a colors restaurant and training center in Oakland, and they approached me with this idea, like, given that fine dining is historically very white, they wanted to find someone to work with to develop some sort of systematized way to create a more equitable environment where opportunity is more open, which they call the racial equity program. And so because of the work I've done at Local, they approached me and I was like, yeah, let's do this, because I was trying to figure out how to approach that problem, and I really needed some kind of partnership of someone who could provide not just resources, but perspective. And so we've been working on that. We worked on it for about 6 months, and this is a dozen people working close to full time to kind of develop systems to create equity in how people are paid, how they're hired, how they're trained, how they're advanced. They did a full assessment of our restaurants and talked to everyone, and then we made this transition about a year ago.
Right.
And it's been really, really wonderful. And so what happened was all of this stuff around sexual harassment started to come out. And obviously, the gender discrimination and racial discrimination are very closely linked. They're both part of a systemic problem in our country, in our wider society that becomes distilled within our restaurants. And so I basically, there was a lot. No one was saying anything, you know, among the fine dining chefs, like. Everyone was kind of like not listening, and so I just wanted to basically just say, hey, you know, we can talk honestly and openly about where we're at, how we got here, and maybe there's some ways that we can actually do something about it. Here's some stuff we're working on, and and maybe we can, and the thing that I really wanted to express was that maybe if the desire was there, we could all work together. And I'm talking about not just restaurant owners, but the workers, the nonprofit and advocacy groups could all together develop ways of creating a better and more equitable restaurant environment. So that was really what that was about.
Right. And I love the idea of using restaurants as a way to tackle these systemic issues and, you know, like believing that restaurants don't have to be like inherently like unjust, and it's just the way that it is and the way that, you know, restaurants have operated and blah, blah, blah. And I think with local, you've shown that, you know, restaurants can actually be a reflection of a community instead of, you know, a business coming into a community. Can you talk a little bit about local, like a little more for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, so that's a partnership with Roy Choi, who's a LA chef, who, you know, basically created this modern idea of what a food truck can be, of taking very high-level disciplines, cooking skills, and applying it to street food. And so one thing that I've noticed that has been persistent is the stories that the media tells are sometimes counterproductive to crossing perceived boundaries and working together. And so they always say it's a very odd couple, even though our values are completely aligned. But we look different, we come from different backgrounds. But the fact is that we both have this shared idea that we should feed more people. We should feed people in communities where they aren't being fed, and we should open up economic opportunity to communities where that has been systematically denied. And so the idea of local is really simple. It's that. It's let's feed people, let's hire people from the community, and let's create opportunity, and let's hope that we do it well and other people follow behind us.
Mm-hmm. What you said is so true. Like when the first local was opening up, the conversation was like, you know, food truck chef and fine dining chef come together, kind of this like odd couple storyline, but you both essentially do the same thing and are working towards the same goals.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and you know, the narratives that we have in our country, the stories that we tell each other about who we are and how the world is run so deep and are so much a part of the systematic oppression in our country, broadly speaking, that it's hard for anyone, I think, who grows up here to break away from those, to see things in a different light. And so we definitely found a lot of that. But in the communities, we also found just an incredibly positive response. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have people working in my fine dining restaurants who started at local. Roy has people working for him who started local. So this is not just, you know, the other part of fast food restaurants is that they're a contributor to the cycle of poverty within a lot of communities. And so to create an open-ended path so that you could start there and then move to somewhere else is a big part of what local's all about.
Mm-hmm. I think that term is so interesting, the open-endedness of it, because I think a lot of business owners think about employment at their business and that's it. And I think the industry moves forward when you think about, well, what's next and who's behind me and how do we make sure that the people behind you have opportunities as well?
Yeah. I mean, very much in the history of our country has been the people who wants to get in and want to close the door behind them, right?
So
which benefits the people that have already kind of passed through those portals, and that's why the gatekeeper issue is so so problematic. And so that this is kind of like, okay, well, you know, maybe let's just keep it open and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So you also work with Alta Restaurant Group, correct? Or your restaurant group was acquired by them. And I read that there's a new restaurant, Kaya, that you're involved in the opening process of.
Yeah, it's open now. We've been open for a week and a half. It's going really well.
Wow.
So this is in a restaurant space that once housed the original Alta.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to move it. We are, in a few months, going to move it to a new hotel down the street. And I can't have two businesses the same, three blocks away from each other, so trying to figure out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually having dinner in Kingston 11, which is a Jamaican-Caribbean restaurant in Oakland. And I know the owners there through Rock. We're on a board together. And the food just really just kind of knocked me out. Like, it was so delicious and really deep, complex flavors. And I loved the place. And I thought, well, we could do something together. You know, he doesn't have a foothold in San Francisco. And San Francisco really needs this food, this culture. Because, you know, our food scene here has a tendency to repeat itself sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously, you know, other factors going on in San Francisco. There's been a diminishment in businesses owned by people of color. There's been a lot of developments that have kind of led to a more, you know, monochromatic food scene. And so I thought all of these things together, like, we could make this really amazing space, but also we could kind of say, well, what do we want San Francisco to be like? And I think it'd be better if we had more diverse options. And so I approached them, and the owner, Nigel Jones, who's the chef, was very excited about it. And so mm-hmm. it's basically a 50-50 partnership. And it's, you know, the role of our restaurant group is to basically support and enact his vision.
Mm. Yeah, it looks incredible. And as you said, a week and a half it's been open?
Yeah, so we didn't do much of a turnaround time because the space was already, you know, really perfect. So
mm-hmm.
We did some painting and new artwork and some menu training, and then we opened on the 11th.
Mm. That's awesome. So you talked about the San Francisco restaurant scene and kind of what you'd want that to look like in the future, like more dynamic and more diverse. As far as the restaurant industry as a whole, what would you like to see that look like? Like, what would the restaurant being more equitable look like to you?
That's a great question. So, I guess, you know, fundamentally there's wage parity,
mm-hmm.
Both from the standpoint of front of the house to back of the house, and then also if you were to look at the gender and racial compositions of each of those groups, which is what, you know, Rock was really focused on, to make sure there's parity within those groups,
mm-hmm.
I would say the standardization of how restaurants do business to remove implicit bias, which is a big problem across, you know, almost every sector of the industry. One thing that Rock is working on is a campaign called One Fair Wage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal because across the country, there's only, I think, 8 states that don't have a tip credit.
Wow.
And the problem with that is that when you're making $213 or $290 or $320 an hour, and most of your tips come from wages for servers, that those jobs are not mostly in fine dining. They're mostly in Denny's and Olive Garden and other places where it puts the workers, who are mostly women and mostly women of color, in a position where they have to put up a lot with a lot of harassment and abuse from their customers, and then also it makes them vulnerable to their managers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, you know, it's not so much a wage issue as it is even more a social justice issue and an equity issue. And so that's something that I think is really important, even though it makes businesses really hard to run that are used to paying, you know, $3 an hour for their front of house labor.
Right.
And I think that creating more opportunity in fine dining, but then also creating more ownership stake for women and people of color, for And also, I think re-looking at maybe the role the media has in the storytelling that mm-hmm. has helped participate in creating the culture that we have, and maybe could they do it differently, and maybe, if you look at maybe, 25 or 30 of the biggest markets across the country, and you look at who the restaurant reviewers are, they're all white and right. 70% male.
Right.
So what does that do when everything is being seen through one lens? And so like all of those things I think of are things that are maybe worth addressing.
Mm-hmm. I'm in here like nodding because all of those things, especially like from my perspective as a food writer, I think the food criticism component is so important. What you said earlier about making sure that the door is open, I think the door needs to be open. Different people need to be in the room and at the table when things are being rebuilt, because it's been mostly just white men building these structures. So we need to take another look at them.
Yeah, I totally agree.
We talked about the future that you see for the industry, but you've done so many different projects, and now you have a Caribbean restaurant in California. What do you want to do next? Like, what projects do you want to take on as a chef?
We have three more projects lined up and for this year, and they're all partnerships.
Oh,
and
wow.
Two of them are kind of like Kaya, that they're giving prominence and voice to different cultural perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also really working on creating intentional spaces where that are focused on inclusion and positivity and kind of energy that I think that a restaurant can have
mm-hmm.
that might create change. People coming in and just have their consciousness shifted a little bit by who is serving them and what the food is and how it feels and maybe taking something away from it
mm-hmm.
that changes them in some way. And so those are things we're focused on right now. As a chef, as a cook, excited to work with the people that we work with and figure out how to support them, how to learn from them. So that learning is like a huge part of what I think any cook gets joy from.
Mm.
And so that's something that I'm excited about. But yeah, there's no like I am going to be chef at X. And, that's
mm-hmm.
like not a right now thing, which is weird for someone who was a chef for so long.
Right. Right. That's, I feel like it's like more conceptual at this point, that you're looking at the industry as a whole, from like 30,000 feet and thinking about where you can make an impact, which is great.
Yeah.
All right.
Trying.
So. All right, so we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more with Chef Daniel Patterson.
Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
All right, welcome back to A Hungry Society, and we're talking to Chef Daniel Patterson. So, do you have any memories of dining when you were growing up? Were there certain traditions that your family had when dining together?
Let's see. One thing I remember, and it's terribly cliche, but my grandmother, mm-hmm. On my mother's side of the family was a great cook, and I spent a lot of time with her, like with my grandparents, and then specifically with her in the kitchen. I watched her cook, and just the kind of generosity of spirit, and the way that she worked, and the way that the food tasted really made a big impression on me, especially when she was cooking for the groups of people, like the broader family. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the restaurant experience that I had when I was young were pretty limited. Mm-hmm. We just didn't go out very much. I went out with my grandparents, and particularly my grandfather, to when we would visit them, and it would be a real special occasion. And I remember there was something very celebratory about it, and something really transformative mm-hmm. about those experiences that I always loved. And I guess those are the things that really kind of stuck with me the most.
Were they like fine dining restaurants that you would go to, or was it like kind of casual?
Oh yeah. I mean, no, they were, like a steakhouse or something that was like, certainly had not been opened any time in the last like 30 years. So they were like fancy from another era, mm-hmm. you know?
Were there Gyarados being wheeled around?
No. No, it was more like early bird specials.
Oh, okay. So like baked potato on the side kind of steakhouse,
yes, exactly.
Type place. And were there any other restaurant experiences that you remember? Like one that maybe like shaped you as a chef a little later?
Let me think about this. So I spent time in France when I was a kid, and when I was 14, I do remember going to like a Michelin star restaurant where, it just kind of opened my mind about a kind of like a level of food that I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. And I remember some of the things I had there to this day, which were very, very simple, like turbo with butter sauce. And so it's the kind of thing that, now it just doesn't seem like very exciting. But in that moment, like the quality of the product and the way it was prepared, I'd never seen anything like it. You know, and I grew up on the water, eating seafood, and it was like a revelation. So, that was definitely a moment. But I started working in restaurants when I was 14, started washing dishes and kind of worked my way up from there. I was very inspired and taken by this idea of personal transformation through work, through this kind of creative expression. Mm-hmm. You could kind of make yourself into someone better somehow. And so like when I got into restaurants and I got into kind of a few years in, then I started to seek out different experiences and go to different restaurants and to understand them in different ways. But mm-hmm. It was probably not until I was like 19 or 20 that I started to go to those kind of places.
Right. And now, as someone who owns like multiple concepts, how do you approach creating experiences for your diners?
That's a great question. I mean, now we work very collaboratively with each other, like the people who run the restaurants, and then also when we partner with someone like with Nigel, or with Roy or anyone. So I think, partly it's we look for a place that's pleasurable, you know, that's warm and inviting, that you go in and you feel like right away, you know, you're in someone's home, you know, that they're going to take care of you. And then, you know, from the standpoint of food, I think, you know, there's a place like Qua, right, which was always kind of more based on challenging expectations or reforming them or creating something that's new that hasn't existed before. And that was really its kind of its spirit, is to never stand still and to kind of be continually reinventing. But a lot of restaurants aren't like that. And so I spent so long in a restaurant that was continually, that was very idiosyncratic and always kind of breaking waves, you know, that in a more casual restaurant took a long time to kind of understand how they function and how to meet people where they are in a lot of different ways. And so, you know, really we focus on on happiness and, you know, how do you make people happy and how do you create a space where they come and they have a good time and they feel taken care of?
Mm. It's interesting, those two things kind of juxtaposed, of like a very ambitious fine dining restaurant. Can those spaces be like warm and inviting or fun and joyful, or are they always kind of just by their nature a little more like strict? What do you think?
Oh, no, I mean, I hope both, right?
Right.
So, the thing about Qua is it was a very, it was kind of a very weird restaurant when it opened, because it had this California hippie vibe.
Mm-hmm.
It was next to a strip club in a part of town that not associated with fine dining. It was a lot of handmade elements, even in the decor. We didn't open it for a lot of money. And so the vibe was always very neighborhood restaurant. Mm-hmm. And actually, I thought it was going to be more conservative when I opened. And I'm not that conservative. So that didn't last very long. But it always maintained. So I wrote about this a little bit in the Qua cookbook, but there was this moment where my wife's mother was, when she passed away, and she's from Northern California, about 3 hours north in the mountains, and I remember getting there. She'd been sick for a little while, and my wife was in, my fiance was there with her sister and family, and just going there and feeling this kind of grief that I'd never seen before, and I just didn't know what to do. So everyone was hungry, so I just started cooking for people. And to spend 3 days in that house, everyone that came through to pay respects, to make plans, to do all the things that happen when someone passes away. And I just cooked through the whole thing. And it kind of, I was in between restaurants at that point, and it really connected me in a really profound way to what it means to cook for someone and to why we do it. And so I think that one of the things that we've done successfully at Qua, that's always been a core element. That's like one of the things that we always go back to over and over, is that feeling of what it means to cook for someone. So I think in that regard, all restaurants kind of have that component. And I just think in terms of, you know, this very narrow measurement of how a place is perceived and why people go there and what you're actually serving, there tends to be a lot more variability.
Right.
That makes sense.
Wow. That's what a profound experience for a chef. Do you do a lot of cooking with your family now, or do you guys go out to eat a lot?
Oh yeah. I mean, definitely. I unfortunately work a lot, so I don't get to cook at home as much as I'd like to, but we definitely cook at home, sit down together as a family. My wife's a really good cook, and we do a lot of stews, a lot of stuff that's long cooked that you can put in the oven in the morning and take it out later, or cook it overnight, and a salad and some rice or something like that. So we eat really simply at home, but you know, just use good ingredients, and then also, you know, try and bring the kids into it so they kind of understand a little bit about how to put a dish together and how to chop things and, you know, all the stuff they're going to need to know someday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a teaching experience, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So my last question for you, and I ask every guest this, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
I would never have my last meal in a restaurant.
Okay.
I would have it in someone's house, and it would be friends and family. And I think that, you know, one of the challenges about restaurants is that there's this place where commerce and the kind of spirituality mm-hmm. collide a little bit. And, you know, I feel like if you kind of get down to what really matters, it's the people, right?
Right.
The restaurants are about people.
Right.
And so we end up talking a lot about trends and techniques and all of this stuff that kind of, it's like these little baubles and shiny things that attract people in.
Mm-hmm.
But what restaurants really at their core is people. And so if I think about a last meal, which I'm not quite ready for yet, but you never know, I would hope that it was just a lot of people that I love and it was a time that we could spend together. And I guess that would be the most important thing.
What would you eat? Like, what would you want on the menu?
That's a great question. I think probably it wouldn't be a formal meal at all.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, there'd be food in the kitchen and people would drift through and eat and, you know, talk and maybe even, you know, drink something too.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, if it's the last meal, you know, you want it to last a long time, right?
Right, exactly.
So I would hope it would go into the night and it would be more of like a, you know, kind of a banquet that just kept going than just like a formal sit down meal. And we'd just eat things that were delicious and simple but I can't think of anything in particular.
Just delicious food and some wine, or would it be cocktails or?
I mean, both. Why not?
Yeah, that's true. Why not have everything?
I mean, it could be tacos. It could be, something like jerk chicken. It could be a vegetable stew. It could be salads. It could be anything, you know, that's delicious. But I think it would be something that would speak to the people that were there. And it would be more important than the actual things. But, you know, I it definitely wouldn't be some kind of like super fancy,
right.
You know, constricting meal, because like, you know, if that's going to be a celebration, then it should be celebration food.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, that is all that I had to ask you. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
And where can listeners find out more information about the projects that you're working on?
About the racial equity program,
mm-hmm.
So ROC United, ROC United, their website has all of the information, and they actually have a toolkit. And if you're interested, I think there's you can contact them, and they'll help. You know, because the idea is that get more places to do it. So then obviously anyone can reach out to us, and you know, we would provide any of our documents or help in any way we could.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Chef.
All right. Well, thanks, and have a great day.
And thank you for listening to A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ha ha ha.